Hello, everybody, and welcome to another Book and a Chat with me, Barry.
Get up in the morning, second thing you do, put on the kettle, make a little brew, that'll do you. Tickety-boo. See you, Jimmy, don't you agree? Only one thing better than a nice cup of tea, and that'll be two. Tickety-boo. Blow away the cobwebs and stop yawning. A little cup and sorcery is magic in the morning, or in the afternoon, or in the evening too. Cheer yourself up, pour yourself a cup, tickety-boo.
Good evening, one and all. I know, middle of another week, towards the end of April already. And yes, I am back from my holiday. I just arrived back on Sunday after my 8-9 days back home in England. See the family, go to my niece's wedding, finally. It's only the third attempt that they've had at doing it, but yes, finally got to the wedding. And I haven't really got any stories. Everything was planned pretty good. There was a couple of little incidents, but nothing like the last time. If you remember the last time I went over there, everything that went wrong could have gone wrong. But I had it all pretty planned. I think the one thing was when we got to Birmingham, because I went from Dublin to Birmingham, from New York to Dublin to Birmingham. They couldn't find anybody to bring steps to the plane, so we sat in there for 40 minutes while... So yeah, I thought we were going to have to go down the chute or something, but yes, trying to get somebody to bring some steps so that we could get off the plane. And then coming back, I think it was when I got to JFK, waiting an hour for the cab because they couldn't find where I was standing. But apart from that, everything was great. The weather was good and I had a good time, but I am back. And I am back with, well, half a guest. Well, not half a guest. It's a joint writing effort, and we have one of the authors here with us. Now, what can you get if you get two award-winning authors, one whose book was made into a film, and been all over the place, especially in Berlin, which gives you a hint about it, and the other one, one of the best books of 2013, and all sorts of other, both award-winning novelists, shall I say. Well, the answer is we get a smashing book, and hopefully we'll hear more about it, because on the show today I have one of the co-authors, we'll find about the other minute, the one and only Alan A. Winter. Hi, Alan, how are you doing?
I'm fine, Barry, and thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
It's a pleasure. Let me just say that you are the one half, and the other half, who isn't with us but who would have been, is Herbert J. Stern. Before we start talking about each of you individually, how did you get together? What sort of drove you to actually jointly write this book?
Well, we've known each other for about 45 years. We're friends. We each write our own books. And Herb is a litigating attorney at this point, but he has a very illustrious other careers that I can talk about in a moment. But I asked him a question. I had an idea for a novel about a lawyer, and he looked at me and said, "You don't want to write about that. You want to write about Hitler." And I looked at him and said, Herb, what could we possibly say about Adolf Hitler that has not been said before? And this is about 5 or 6 years ago. Mm-hmm. And in his inimitable way, he said, "You'd be surprised. Let's have dinner." We both live in New Jersey. So we went to a local restaurant. And New Jersey is wonderful because you have a lot of bring-your-own, bottles,
right?
Restaurants at BY. And so over a great bottle of wine, we talked about things that people didn't know about Hitler. And the more we delved into it, the more we realized that a lot of history has neglected key aspects of his life, the Nazi life, how they came to power, etc. So that was the origin of how we started. And once we got into it, we were compelled to not only write one book, but write two books together.
Oh, right. Because Herb, as you said, Herbert J. Stern, he's, as you said, law firm sort of thing like that. And he even did about the... in Berlin, wasn't he judge at some hijacking or something?
Yes. Well, all right. Herb's pedigree is impeccable. He started out as an assistant prosecutor in New York and was involved in the Malcolm X assassination and prosecuted those defendants. He then became the prosecutor for the state, the federal prosecutor for New Jersey, and created a terrific career of putting away a lot of corrupt politicians, which New Jersey has no shortage of. And after doing that, they made him the youngest federal judge in the history of the United States at that time. I think he was 34, 36 years old. And as you said, there was a hijacking from Gdansk, Poland to West Berlin. This is back around 1979. And the Germans didn't want to deal with it because of treaty concerns of returning hijackers to the place of origin. This was an East German that was trying to escape to West Germany.
Yes, I remember.
Well, they called up Herb, the State Department, and said, we want you to be the judge of Berlin. So he was made judge of Berlin. And it was the first time in history that the Constitution of the United States was applied outside of the territory of the United States. It was at Tempelhof Airport. He insisted that they build a courtroom. They had the trial. They had trial by jury, which they never had before, and they still don't have in Europe. He insisted on it, and that worked out. And then ultimately he wrote a book about his experiences called, as you said before, Judgment in Berlin, which was made into a movie. And the very cool thing was that Martin Sheen played Herb.
Right. And Sean Penn was in it, wasn't he, as well, if I remember
right? Yeah. Sean Penn's mother was in it. Yeah. It was a wonderful book. It was a good movie. And he had written another compelling book, A Diary of a DA, about all the people that he had put away. A lot of the cases, a lot of the stories of The Sopranos were based on Herb's cases.
This is the fellow
that I wrote a book with, who has very strong opinions, is a wonderful guy, and we get along fabulously. And we decided to write this book about Hitler. And it started off with a premise, Barry, which is important for your readers or listeners to understand, is that, you know, he posed a question, a very simple question. Do you know that Adolf Hitler was in a mental institution at the end of World War One? And my answer was no. I had never heard of it. And I went to the history books. I said, go look in the history books, you know, the well-known ones. And we did. Yep. And it really wasn't there either. They might have said his eyes were affected by a gas attack, which is true. But there was nothing organically wrong with him. And from that, we began to find a whole host of things that are incorrectly portrayed in biographies of him and history books of him. Perhaps the historians didn't know how to deal with it over the years because of the Holocaust.
Right.
But we felt that history should not be censored by historians. Mm-hmm. And that our goal was to write a story that would be informative, that would correct the historical record, but at the same time be a page turner, because in order to tell this story, we had to create a fictitious character, which immediately put the book into historical fiction as a category.
Okay, which is great. I mean, I'll get to that in a minute. But yeah, before, we've just talked about her, but you know, you yourself, 4 or 5 books, including Kirkus, which was selected as the best book of 2013. So you're no mean writer yourself, Alan.
Thank you. No, I had 4 novels before that.
Yeah. Right. It's interesting. You know, what you say about, and this is your book, Sins of the Fathers, between with mm-hmm. this, which you and Herb wrote. But it's interesting what you say about the amount of stuff and information that you know, is forgotten, hidden, or just never discovered. I was watching the that History Channel program about tracing Hitler and stuff like that, and all the sorts of things that they found, like that great big submarine base in the Canary Islands, and they said that people had never sort of seen before. And when you said about Hitler ending in, you know, at the end of First World War, I seem to remember reading, or I might actually, perhaps it was World of War, because we were forced to watch World of War in England by my parents. They wanted to see, this was in the 50s, sort of late 50s, well, early 60s perhaps, because my parents wanted us to see the truth of the stuff, because obviously the news rules and everything were fresh in those days and that sort of thing. But When you sort of started looking at it, as you said, the two of you sort of got together and went in, did it surprise you how much just either had been forgotten or just wasn't really known?
Well, shocking was a better word. Surprise isn't strong enough, I'll be honest with you. And it wasn't forgotten. It wasn't dealt with, and it wasn't dealt with in a forthright way in many different respects. For instance, we would look at a citation of something in his history book or a biography of Hitler, and then we would follow the reference, and we'd look at that reference, and they would refer to the same person. And then what we found was a tremendous, I hate to say this, but a tremendous amount of plagiarism, a tremendous amount of lack of research that if one notable historian wrote something, then everybody felt it was fair game to say it without researching whether it was true or not. Well, we didn't do that. Herb, as a litigating attorney, as a prosecutor, as a judge, and I have a history as a background, that we delve, we got into the original documents. We went to the original libraries where papers were, interviews. For instance, Michael Musmano ended up as a Supreme Court judge in the state of Pennsylvania. He was a lawyer at the end of World War II. He interviewed every living person that had dealt with Hitler on a personal level, whoever was still alive in 1946, 47, 48. And one of his charges was by the Smithsonian was to prove that the Holocaust existed through these interviews. Now, all these interviews are at Duquesne University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And so we used those as an example. And what we began to find was that many of the truths, and I can explain some in a second, were written by very capable journalists, historians, people who were doing biographies, but they were published in the 1950s and 60s and early 70s. And those books are no longer used. They had the truths. They had greater accuracy than the last 25 or 30 years of people that have been knighted by your original country. I'm not going to mention names because I don't want to do that, but as an example, they would say that Hitler was a subhuman, an unhuman, a black hole, that he was an abyss. That he couldn't have a relationship with a human being, that he couldn't be a friend, that he didn't like women, that he was either homosexual or he had kinky sexual, all of which is untrue. Everything I just mentioned is untrue. And what they didn't want to deal with, they, the historians, they, the biographers, they didn't want to deal with the man. So does that make us wrong, Herb and I wrong, that we said, look, he puts his pants on one leg at a time, he's like normal people, he has warts like other people, whatever it is, he's got blemishes, but he was also described as uneducated. Well, he was highly educated. He was self-taught. He didn't go through school very much, but he had a eidetic memory, photographic memory. He just could quote every libretto of Wagner. He could draw Notre Dame Cathedral down to a gargoyle from memory and be perfectly precise. This was not an uneducated man. This is a cultured 19th century German, or Austrian, actually, excuse me, Austrian, who adored women, and women adored him. And no one wanted to portray that because, and the reason is this, I mean, are we doing a disservice to humanity because we're describing, it could be the most vile person of the 20th century of all time. Although Putin is beginning to try and take his place, I think, or at least give him a run for his money, which we should discuss. But the point is, if you're looking for a demigod, if you're looking for someone who burned cats and dissected animals live, and that will be a dictator that will cause a genocide, that's not what they are. They are psychopaths that live in society that you don't know they are until they go over the other edge. And that's why we wrote these books.
Well, because Wolf was the first book. This is the second book, is that right?
Correct. Wolf is what Hitler used to call himself, by the way. Sign in to hotels, sign cards to girlfriends. And Adolf is a variation of Adawolf, which is how the name came about.
So Wolf
is the first name. We took that from the mental institution to 1934 when Hindenburg died and Hitler abolished the office of president and declared that he was both chancellor and president, and ergo, he was the Führer at that point. And so that's what Wolf is about, how he came to power, how the German society, in a way, allowed it to happen, what were the dynamics. And we did this, this is important to say because we're talking about books. We did this by asking the question, who was in the bed next to Hitler in the mental institution? So we created a character who had no memory. He was in a shelling attack, lost his memory. He was blown to bits. A plastic surgeon put him back together. And he couldn't remember who he was. No one claimed him, if you will. There was no family. And so the only person he knew was the lunatic in the bed next to him, who was ranting and raving. He's blind, he's blind, he's blind. He befriends him, and our character becomes Hitler's friend. And he is the eyes and ears of the reader.
We
take the reader inside the creation of the Nazi Party, inside how they become powerful, and ultimately how Hitler becomes chancellor. And we do it, we think, as objectively as possible to see how this dynamic works. And then Sins of the Father is how he then methodically changes the laws, becomes the dictator, tries to get rid of the Jews, and tries to begin to set the stage for World War II and where it could have been stopped.
Yeah,
and that's a critical part of the book.
Exactly, because there was a plot by German military leaders, wasn't there, or something like that, to overthrow him. But Chamberlain, in all his wonderful wisdom that we hear about all the time, he didn't back it up, and it went bad from there.
It went very bad from there. In essence, Neville Chamberlain saved Hitler's life, and he paved the way for World War II.
Yep.
And that's a big statement. But all the information that we gleaned, all of the attempts to avoid this happened. So let's go back, if you don't mind, to the conspiracy of the military leaders. What the German military leaders knew is that if they had another great war, they were going to lose. They knew it. This is 1937, 1938.
Mm-hmm.
Hitler announced very publicly that he was out to invade Austria and Czechoslovakia. He then made statements which are shocking. He said and explained to the heads of his military, the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, his foreign service, he said, look, I expect 2 million Czechs to die. I expect 1 million Austrians to die. There will be more food for us because we need more foodstuffs. And we will expand. Liebestraum was the German word
right.
for expansion.
Expansion, yep.
Exactly. And the German officers, the high-ranking chief of staff, head of the War Department, see, you can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they didn't really care that much about Austria. They were German-speaking. It is not true that Austria or Germany was separated. They were not together to begin with. But Czechoslovakia was a different story.
Right.
Czechoslovakia was a democracy that was created. It was a mutt. It was created at the end of World War I by the Allies. That they took a piece of Germany, a piece of Poland, a piece of Romania, and Hungary, and they put it together and put the Slavs and the Czechs together, and that became Czechoslovakia. And the German military said, you can't go in there. It's a democratic country. They didn't do anything to us. And Hitler said, we have the right to do what we want to do. We are the greatest. And he just believed in that, and obviously he was going to move eastward. He needed raw materials. Germany was lacking in a lot. They couldn't go any further in growth because of all of the embargoes that were imposed upon mm-hmm. them by the Treaty of Versailles. And Hitler was going to do it. And every time he tried to augment the strength and power of Germany from 1935 on,
by starting conscription, by having a plebiscite in the Saar Valley, by going into the Rhineland and retaking the industrial, the coal industries back. Mm-hmm. No one stopped him. No one said a word. No one said you can't do that, which is way different than what's going on today in the Ukraine, where right. the countries of the world are raising their voices, thank God.
Right.
Whether or not it's enough, I don't know. But the point is, the times are different now. That's one of the things that is different about Putin and Ukraine. But getting back to our German military, what they did was they formed a resistance unit. This is 1938, February of 38, mm-hmm. which is a year and something before World War II started on September 1st in Poland. Yep. So it's more than a year and a half earlier. And they sent emissaries not only to England, but to Sweden, to Switzerland, to Belgium, to America. And different men went. No one listened to them. No one wanted to hear them. They got to meet maybe secretaries in the cabinet. They didn't get to the leaders of the country because they didn't come with a portfolio like, represent Adolf Hitler and the German. But where they tried the most and who was most important was England and Chamberlain. Mm-hmm. And Chamberlain wouldn't see, he knew about them. He was well aware of the resistance. And all they wanted, Barry, all they wanted was for him to step up to a microphone and make a radio announcement that if Hitler, if you cross the frontier and go into Czechoslovakia, there will be war.
Right.
Now, what he meant by that and what the resistors wanted was that statement as a declarative statement, but not that they would mobilize England or anything like that, their soldiers, because the dynamic was already there. France and Russia had signed a pact to protect Czechoslovakia.
Right.
England would always back France. Mm-hmm. And the French army, believe it or not, was a better army at that moment than Germany was. The Czechs were great fighters. Mm-hmm. And Hitler said, you know what, I don't believe any of this. I just don't believe it. I'm going to do what I want to do. Mm-hmm. And no matter how they implored the people around Chamberlain, and they ended up going to Robert Vansittart, who was kicked up in the Foreign Service. He was sort of emeritus at this point. But they allowed him to see Winston Churchill. And it's important to bring Winston Churchill into this. Churchill saw Hitler from day one. I mean, 1932, 33. Yeah. He was absolutely saying, you cannot trust this man. He's going to create another great war. It will be devastating. And when the German emissary, his name was Kleist, went there on behalf of the German military with letters of introduction, Winston Churchill welcomed him with open arms. He said, I would write you a letter that we could show to the German military, and I'll do what I can, but I don't have the power. And two things are important here, and then I'll stop because I feel like I'm...
Oh, no, no. This is about you and the book, so this is fine, but go ahead.
So what happened there is that in February of 38, by February of 38, Hitler had removed everyone at the highest level of the military that opposed him. So he abolished the office, the War Department. He abolished it completely. He changed the chief of staff of the army. He changed the foreign secretary. He brought Ribbentrop from England, who was a wine salesman, and made him head of the foreign secretary. And basically had all yes men surrounding him so that he could then go into Austria and Czechoslovakia and do whatever he wanted to do. Right. Well, Chamberlain did the same thing.
Right.
He got rid of Anthony Eden.
Yep.
He put Halifax in his place. And he surrounded him with people who were for appeasement.
Right.
So you've got these two leaders who are surrounding themselves with people that of like philosophy. And they were at loggerheads. And the German military officers, they realized, wait a second, you know what? No one's going to help us. We have to do this ourselves. And it was T minus a few hours. They had generals in place.
roads were going to be blocked. They were going to surround the chancellery where Hitler was. They were going to Karen Hall, where Goring lived. They were going to take the radio station. They were going into the Gestapo headquarters. And Chamberlain, it's not a spoiler alert because we all know that World War II occurred.
Right.
Chamberlain flies to Munich, never been in a plane before, flies there, and what begins is a series of two or three meetings.
Right.
And he meets with Hitler and basically hands him what he wants and gives him entree to Czechoslovakia
right.
without a shot being fired.
Right. Yeah.
And it's just sad. It's sad that happened. And Chamberlain believed that he did the right thing.
Yeah, I'm PC in our times, isn't it? I have in my hand a paper signed by Herr Hitler, as you said, at the top of the plane steps and stuff like that. You're right. It's interesting,
exactly.
though. You go through what you're saying and everything, and then we look in Ukraine, and you know the whole thing—the erosion of rights and freedoms, the putting yes men in place, getting rid of traditional values. You know, scapegoats, people disappearing, et cetera, et cetera. It's like people don't learn their lessons. It's the same thing all over again. Though this time, I must admit, even the likes of Ireland and Sweden and Switzerland are actually opening their mouths, which they've never done before, to condemn the thing. But it's the same process. You can see this coming, I'd have thought, and yet we don't learn our lessons.
Well, no, and of course you don't. If you don't know history, you're condemned to repeat it. You know, Santana said that. The problem, there's good and bad out of what you just said, and then the good, unfortunately, doesn't balance the bad. The good is that the countries did open their mouths currently, Switzerland and Ireland, like you're saying, Sweden. The Swiss have always been neutral, and they've opened their mouth. And from day one. President Biden has been saying things, and he's a war criminal.
Right.
And he's everything else. But the problem is, they still are afraid that Putin's a loose cannon, and maybe they're going to he threatens a nuclear bomb of some sort.
Yeah.
These are bullies.
Yep.
And words really don't matter to them, and they're psychopaths.
Yes.
And Putin has lost this war conceptually, even if he takes the area of eastern Ukraine. I don't know how this is going to end. I fear for it, but I agree with you that we have not learned our lesson. And that was one of the reasons that we wrote both of these books,
right.
was to say, look, if you just read this and see what happens and how pathologic leaders function, then we can take a stronger stand. We have not taken a strong enough stand for Ukraine right now, in my opinion.
I agree totally. And I tell you, I could go on chatting to you for at least another hour. But time is beating us, I'm afraid, Alan. What I'm going to do now, and it's been fantastic talking to you about this whole thing, Wolf, and now the new one, Sins of the Fathers. But what I'm going to do now is hand the show over to you so you can tell everybody where people can find out more about yourself, Herb, and of course the books. So over to you.
Thank you so much. Okay, well, the easiest thing is that both of us have our own websites. So mine is my name, Alan Winter, ALANWINTER.com. Herb's is Herbert J. Stern, so it's Herbert J. Stern, all one word, .com. And you can find out about all of our books on both of our websites. And through those websites, you can then be directed to either Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Indie, wherever you buy books. So the books are available in the stores. I know they're in Barnes & Noble stores, and they're there. I'm available by email. All my information is there to get these books.
That's great. Well, Alan, thank you so much for being a guest on the show today. I've really enjoyed it. It's been fascinating. And good luck to yourself and Herb.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it as well. It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much, Barry.
My pleasure. Thank you. Well, there you go. My guest today, one of the two people who wrote this fascinating, well, Wolf is the first one, but the new one is Sins of the Fathers. And that is Alan A. Winter, who with Herbert J. Stern wrote that book. Absolutely fantastic. And when you think what's going on right now, as we were discussing at the end there, yeah, the similarities and everything are amazing. But it's a really interesting fictional, historical fiction, but it's a lot of truth stuff in the way and everything, as we said. Well, that's it. I'll be back on Sunday from 5 to 6 p.m. with Those Are the Days. And the theme this week is money. Yeah, I finished the show yesterday, so that's the theme this week. And of course, that's followed between 6 and 7 p.m. Eastern with the Swinging 60s, music from the 60s from around the world. And then next Tuesday and Wednesday, be back with a couple of authors. But until then, as always, we have one thing left to say. Don't forget...